live from Burbank, California, where it's World Cup fever. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's wearing a cup. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives and need machines, pain sponges, anybody who's listening. How are you? Hope you had a decent Monday. I know we're coming at you towards the end of the day here, and it's kind of weird for us to be talking about the weekend, but we're taping this right now during the day, so I want to talk about the weekend, Jim. How was your weekend, Jim?
You know, we did a lot of things, but the most important thing was watching Ted Nugent on Supergroup, the new reality show that he's starring in. I'm sorry, it's not very newsy, but to me, it's important.
The Nuge was on Supergroup. What is it? What is it?
With Sebastian Bach, they get all these.
He's on all those VH1 shows, Sebastian Bach. Yeah. But the Nuge, the right wing Nuge, killer of animals.
That's right.
And believer in the type of patriotism that excludes almost everybody that doesn't want to kill animals.
Lover of guns and the American way. You know how he got out of Vietnam War?
Yeah, he crapped on himself.
But he later denied that. But.
Yeah, he crapped on himself and went to the draft board and said, I crapped on myself.
Yeah.
And then he said, Wang dang sweet poon tang.
Yeah.
But, okay, so what is the premise of this reality show, if we're going to talk about it?
You got a bunch of, failed heavy metal artists together, middle-aged to 60 years old. Put them in an apartment for 12 days, and they're supposed to come up with a song and perform live.
So sad old guys whose careers have passed them by, who don't have the juice to actually tour, are locked in an apartment and forced to engage with each other. And the hope is that the big egos will clash and there'll be problems about hair products between Sebastian and Ted. And eventually they'll come up with some crappy retread of one of the songs that one of them did. Yeah. I got to be honest with you. I saw the Nuge 3 times when I was in high school because some of my friends were Nuge fans, and I saw them in the context of other shows. Never liked it. The only song I ever really liked that Nuge did was a cover of a George Harrison song.
Really? Which one?
I want to tell you.
Really? He did that.
And I don't know why. What song is that? I got time.
Bill knows.
It's called what? I got time. I want to tell you. I want to tell. Did everyone hear Bill just pipe in there? I can't tell the difference when we got to figure out a way to get everyone piping in here so we get a group feel going and you can hear what you say. We got to get a real mic in there, Laughing Andy, so you guys can talk like human beings on the radio program. Did they just hear that? They didn't. See, so now what happens now is I just responded to you, and they're not going to hear what you said. And
we'll get some mics, no problem.
Okay, good. That's it. That sounds just
I'm
like
Andy.
Yeah. Today on the show, Leon Panetta, former White House Chief of Staff under Clinton, is going to talk to us about the Panetta Institute and also about what he thinks might ought to be going on in the executive branch there. David Ray Griffin, finally, folks, the time has come. The time has come to reckon. The time has come to engage about what really happened on 9/11, according to the people that spend their lives wondering what really happened on 9/11. I was watching. This is David Ray Griffin. He is a theology and religion professor emeritus. Is that how you say it?
Emeritus.
Emeritus, which means top notch. The big guy, the guy with all the credentials, right? Heavy creds, right?
Yeah, they get to sit around and not even teach anymore.
Right, so he's one of those guys. And apparently with that free time, he has taken it upon himself. This is up at Claremont College, Claremont School, here in California.
Really? Which one?
The one outside of Santa Barbara, I believe.
No,
is there a chain?
Claremont College. My dad was head of the psychology department at Claremont College, just for your info.
Hold on a minute. Your dad was the head of a psychology department?
Yeah, he was head of the psychology department at Claremont Men's College out here near Pomona. Famous colleges out there, yeah.
Well, that's, I believe, where our guest is. So
Now
I just saw a whole party that I never understood. You're the son of a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. It's like Skinner's kid.
He had rat mazes in a garage.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. But how big were they is the question. Were you and your brother in them, or was it for animals?
He did experiments on us, yes.
Like what?
He'd show us these little colored blocks and ask us to choose which one we wanted, and then he'd mark it down. And we never knew until years later what all that meant.
And did he go, it was supposed to be red? red.
There was never a correct answer. He was just studying our reactions.
But didn't it make you self-conscious?
Yeah, because it was annoying. I didn't get anything out of it, and I had to...
My wife was the offspring of a psychiatrist.
Really?
And as someone once commented, he must not be a very good one. And I said, why? And he said, well, he let her marry you, which I thought was incredibly funny and insightful. Hey, I'll tell you one thing that happened to me over the weekend. I sat at home and I was watching television, and Dennis Miller's last HBO special came on, All In, I guess it's called. And this guy, I don't know what the hell happened to this guy, but I got to be honest with you, I've never been on board with Dennis Miller. I always found him condescending and a fraud. I think he's an intellectual fraud who who draws from, you know, fairly clever writers. What he is really an eloquent name caller. And he's had some great writers. We've known some of the guys that have written for him. But what he's doing now, and what makes him reprehensible, is he'll do about 30 minutes in this special of just jokes. And then all of a sudden, he claims to be, you know, an investigator of truth. This guy claims to be an intellect, yet he hits all of the Republican talking points. He discredits global warming. He takes shots at drilling in the Arctic Reserve. You know what his defense of drilling in the Arctic Reserve was?
What?
Who cares about Alaska? I mean, really, who cares
about
it?
That's always been his... That's his M.O. That's his comedic M.O.
But that is so... But this is a guy that some people respect as an intelligent comedian because he strings words together that really are meaningless. They're meaningless. He's just a name caller. And when you really get to the guts of who this guy is in terms of what he feels about things, he's a belligerent, ignorant bully with no concern for anything but himself and his own well-being. I mean, for somebody to dismiss drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve as not being important because, hey, we need the oil. You know, it's like a gift. Or dismiss it as, who cares about Alaska? Here was the joke. The joke, I'm going to paraphrase it. I was thinking about actually bringing some of them in and putting them on, but I don't want to give him the exposure because I think he is just a... He is a guy that comments, that used to comment on ignorant, belligerent, bigoted, bloated American waste. And now he is their spokesperson. He represents the way they think now. He tries not to.
Did he have a joke for the Arctic?
He doesn't try not to. I mean, he's pretending like he's not doing that, but it's exactly what he's doing. He talks about, like, he'll couch things with, like, who the hell elects these politicians? And then the politicians he criticizes were Clinton, Dean, and Hillary. And the way he phrased the thing about Kerry and Bush is he literally said, we need a stupid, basically, to translate, he was saying, we need a stupid, belligerent, reactionary president who's not going to overthink things in order to protect us in this dangerous time. He also defended racism and bigotry in terms of racial profiling in order to fight the war on terror. The joke he had about Alaska was like, you know, I know we all think that we're going to go to Alaska and go fishing for salmon, but you know what? No one goes to Alaska. We're going to Vegas. Because he was taping in Vegas. But you get that, like, woo! That, like, woo, we're stupid, all right! We don't care either, man! That's absolutely right! The hell with the whole global warming thing, that's crap! I mean, with the science around that, for him, why would a comedian even get up on stage and go, eh, I've read the reports, but, you know, jury's not in, babe. You know, like he would literally... He said that, why would he go out of his way to take global warming, make it a comedic premise to say, I don't buy all the reports. Maybe it's just hot out. When I was a kid, I remember it being hot out. I mean, it doesn't serve anything other than to show that he is a stooge. He's a Republican stooge. He's a lackey. He's an ass kisser. This is who he's aligned himself with. And I'm so glad that my instincts were always true about this dirtbag, because he's a dirtbag. If anything, if you're going to be a comic, either be a loudmouth, angry liberal comic, or just be an ass. Don't be a right-wing apologist, because that's not comedy, because that goes against everything comedy is supposed to represent and everything creativity is supposed to represent. There has to be some open-mindedness or some criticism of both sides in order for it to be real.
Well, he's a typical misinformed, ill-informed comic who has false premises, so he can get these huge redneck reactions from an audience, like the Las Vegas joke. We're going to Las Vegas, not the Arctic.
But the premise is like, despite of what anybody thinks, this is just the difference between right-wing and left-wing thinking in terms of appreciation and understanding, is that it doesn't matter if anybody goes up there. The knowledge that it's there and the knowledge that we're protecting something of purity, something of integrity, something of nature, something of the environmental balance that was given to us by whatever great being or whatever great coincidence occurred, is something to be respected. Believe me, whether or not anyone's going there or not, knowing it's there makes me feel a hell of a lot better. If it were just gone, it would be completely forgotten, and it'd be like the only time you'd see this stuff, it'd be like the end of Soylent Green, you know, when Edward G. Robinson's on his way out, and you just get that slideshow of what it used to be like.
If it were gone, his, you know, Malibu estate would be underwater right now.
Yeah, but he'd be like, hey, babe, I got a boat. You know, he doesn't give a crap. I mean, that's the whole thing, but he pretends to be an intellectual. That's what that just irks me. That he pretends to have weighed in on the debate. He dismisses Kerry. Excuse me. He dismisses Kerry, but he was trying to be gracious around the Kerry thing and saying, hey, you know, I like Kerry. He did the whole sort of love the troops thing, defend the country. Like, you know, Kerry fought for us in Vietnam, and my heart goes out to him. God bless him. But I think the war kind of messed with his head a bit in the sense that he would be hesitant. Like, he didn't actually say that, you know, he was some whack job from Vietnam, but he said he was in a war, so he might actually think twice before killing other people. And that bothers me, because in this day and age, we need to kill other people. We need the military to have the right to kill whoever they feel like it. We need to, surrender all our rights in order to kill and protect this country.
We need comics who did coke all through the 80s telling us to kill people.
That's coke all through the 80s? He used to be a prop comic, for Christ's sake. Look, there are other
things.
Yeah,
tell me
started
about that
out. He started out as a prop comic, but it's what he's doing now that is reprehensible. It's a crime against comedy. I will be back in a moment. Jim will be back in a moment. We will be talking to Leon Panetta in a few minutes. But coming up next, we got the environmental news. So stay with us, folks. It's the Mark Maron Show.
And now it's time for this week's disturbing environmental news that'll frighten you, but not enough to really do anything about it. Brought to you by
America's manufacturers and distributors of Schlerm. Hi, I'm Mark Maron. Have you ever imagined what life would be like with nothing? Well, picture a world without Schlerm. Developed over 60 years ago by Nazi scientists, Schlerm, or seriously corrosive hunks of large uranium materials, is today used to make everything from diaphragms to decongestants.
Warning, may cause phlegm.
But most importantly, Schlerm is not biodegradable. Biodegradable. Gosh, that sure is a big sounding word. So let's not talk about it, okay? Simply put, Schlerm means progress. It lasts forever and even helps protect against communism. It's even in your pee. Can you imagine a world without pee? I can't. So why don't you just lighten up, okay? I'm sick of all your damn whining. And there's another thing I can't imagine a world without. Dangerous mood swings. It's all part of the modern miracle of Schlerm.
Warning, may contain ancient Egyptian curses.
And now back to this week's disturbing environmental news. What are you looking at?
Destruction of habitats from global warming is forcing polar bears to resort to cannibalism. Karl Rove pressured the EPA to reduce clean water requirements around oil wells. And like usual, today another 200,000 acres of rainforest were obliterated to help stuff your fat, obtuse faces with hamburgers and steaks. Eat well, barbarians. And that was this week's disturbing environmental news that'll frighten you, but not enough to really do anything about it. Brought to you by
Schlerm! I'm not shouting! All right, so there you go. That's our environmental news for today. We got Leon Panetta in just a few minutes. We're talking about Dennis Miller. I know that's old news to some of you, but I resisted watching it. And I had to put myself through it. I've watched a little bit of television and watched my buddy Louis C.K.'s show. I guess I got to give him a call and get him on his dirty, filthy sitcom. He actually jumped out of bed on the sitcom completely naked yesterday.
Did you
see that?
Oh, I've seen that before in real life.
You've seen Louis jump out of bed naked before?
Yeah.
How?
Well, not bed, off a couch.
Really?
Yeah.
Why, is he sleeping at your house?
No, I was sleeping at somebody's house in Ron Lynch's place in San Francisco years ago.
Right, and but, Louis was staying over there?
Yeah.
Wow, Ron Lynch. I worked with Ron last night. Very funny.
Really?
Very funny. Ron is always funny. Let's talk about the potential nuclear confrontation, not in Iran, but in Korea. Apparently, North Korea wants to launch long-range missiles. They're calling it launch. They're calling it launch, that they're going to launch them. They're not going to call it a test because they want North Korea to understand. Kim Jong-il, they want him to understand that if he does launch them, that they might launch back, that they will see it as a provocative, is that what they call it? A provocative act, and they are going to call it that, a launch, and if he shoots one off, the United States government might shoot one at it. And that's the real deal. Apparently, the idea is that these missiles that they're talking about, these Taipadong 2 missiles, are capable of reaching the U.S. mainland with a nuclear payload. And they don't know what the hell's going on. I mean, they're calling it a test. Maybe it's a test. Maybe it's a launch. But they're standing up on this nuclear face-off with Korea as we sit right here, Jim, and enjoy our show together. Also, Bush gave Iran an ultimatum with some support from the international community about their nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, in Iraq, 3 GIs are being accused of murder for some situations that occurred there. Who knows what's going to happen with Haditha and with any of the other number of questionable instances of abuse on behalf of American soldiers, let alone the fact that 2 have been kidnapped by someone, a group claiming to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. So whatever momentum George Bush was thinking about achieving on his little soiree to Iraq, I think it was all based on crap, because there's actually a report coming out of the Washington Post that basically says this was a security report that was issued the day that George Bush showed up there, that the situation in Baghdad, in the green zone itself, is so out of control that it's really unbelievable that he went there. I don't know if it's a testament to his stupidity and what he's willing to do to get a positive message out before we get to midterms, or he just doesn't care.
And he went to the safest part. He went to the big bunker, the huge, you know, impregnable bunker
in the embassy
that is called the democracy. That
right, right. Well, I mean, it couldn't have been that safe, judging by Bartlett and Snow, that photograph of them wearing the doofus helmets. And I'm not saying all military helmets are doofus, just the ones they gave these guys. And there's some implication that they might have strapped these guys in to look sort of stupid, just to mock them. That coming from our buddy Godless U.S. soldier on the blog, who said that they might have made it a little uncomfortable for
everybody.
Bartlett
looks
and Snow
like a doofus when they're pooping in their pants.
Exactly. Hey, what's that smell? Snow said. But that's old news. Cheney piped in on it today. We'll get into that. Leon Panetta next. Hang out.
And now he's vowed to put a man on the moon by 2024. Mark Maron.
Yes, I will do that. Welcome back to the show. It's Mark Maron's show. You can go to markmaron.com. Seems like we have some new folks down at the Blog Central there. I think my appearance on Cedar's show and the two of us hanging out kind of reawakened people to the fact that I'm still out here doing something. Despite what Air America may have plans for me, or despite what KTLK says, I am still on the air. Leon Panetta was appointed chief of staff to President Clinton on July 17, 1994, and served in that position until January 20, 1997. He now heads the Panetta Institute with his wife Sylvia. The institute is a nonpartisan center for the study of public policy that aims to, basically train people how to govern properly. He's here with us now on the phone. Welcome to the show, Leon Panetta.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
I'm very appreciative of your being here, because before we talk about the institute, I'd like to ask you to share some of your intuition about what might be going on in the inner sanctum of the Bush White House. I mean, there was a shakeup. Andrew Card, who had your job, splits. Do you think it is constant damage control, constant stress, constant spin? What do you think's going on in there?
Well, welcome to the White House.
That's the way it is always.
I think that's right. It's it's the center point of all the action, and as a result, every day is a new crisis. Challenges that face you every day. You've got to try to keep the staff together so they don't fall apart. You got to keep focused. You got to hope you can provide the best information to the president. You have to hope that something doesn't blow up on you that creates an even worse problem, and I'm sure that's what they're doing day to day.
Well, I mean, I guess you have to be somewhat nonpartisan, but I don't know, but because of the Institute. But I mean, it seemed like when you guys were running things, that there was a sense that you were pretty good guys, and that the country believed in you, and you had a good vibe. I mean, these guys, I got to be honest with you, they all seem like creepy, evil people to me.
Well, you know, in the end, all of the people you have around you, no matter how good they are, they still, in large measure, ultimately reflect the president. You know, I'm a believer that the buck always stops with the president, and if the president, you know, wants to convey that kind of sense, that kind of attitude, then that's what's going to happen. They're going to march to his tune, and you know, in the Clinton administration, Clinton was somebody who was always outward, always wanted to meet people, always wanted to think new ideas, always wanted to talk to people about other ideas, basically reached out, and was someone who was not afraid to go out into the public, all strands of the public, went to universities, went to business groups, went to chambers of commerce, went to low-income areas. He was comfortable talking with just about everybody, and I think that reflected itself in a lot of the policies that occurred during that time.
Are you concerned with the policies that this administration is engaged in terms of some of the legislation and obviously the war and some of the constitutional transgressions that they've done?
Well, you know, I'm concerned that people who go back in elective office are sworn to defend, preserve, protect the Constitution of the United States. And everybody ought to take the time to read the preamble to the Constitution because it says an awful lot about what our forefathers wanted. They wanted a country that in which we promoted tranquility. They wanted to have a more perfect union. They wanted to promote justice. They wanted to promote the common welfare, provide for the common defense, but most of all, secure liberties for ourselves and for our posterity. That's what the preamble's all about. And yet in every one of those areas, I get the sense that this country is going in the opposite direction. We're more divided than we ever have been. You know, there's just a horrible kind of political trench warfare going on in Washington that basically takes away from the opportunity to provide any kind of tranquility or provide for the common welfare. And while we're dealing with the common defense, the problem is that this is a country that has a defense system in order to promote peace, not war. And you know, when it comes to our liberties, there's no question that, you know, at a time when we're concerned as a result of 9/11, we're a country that's moved backward. And the whole purpose of this nation is to protect our liberties, to make sure that we're a country that doesn't sacrifice those liberties for other reasons. So I think we've gone backward in all of those areas, and I guess my hope is that someday people recognize what the Constitution is all about and what they're sworn to defend.
Our guest is Leon Panetta, former White House Chief of Staff for Bill Clinton. Just today, or maybe it was yesterday, Dick Cheney said that they have fought to take the power away from the Congress and put it into the executive. And he literally said, quote, they have the balance righted, if you will, and I think we've done that successfully, end quote. That literally they wanted to disempower Congress from being an effective check.
Well, again, you know, they ought to take the time to read what our forefathers intended when they put the Constitution together. The one thing they absolutely feared was that power would be centralized in any one branch of government. They didn't want a king. They didn't want a king parliament. They didn't want a star chamber court. They wanted to make sure that power would not be centralized. And so they created this wonderful system of three separate but equal branches of government, but each was supposed to be a check and balance on the other. When that falls apart, as it has over these last few years, where Congress has exercised absolutely no oversight, has not provided any kind of check to the executive, and the executive has basically done incredible things. I mean, like, you know, 700 signing statements that basically changed the laws that the president signed. When that happens, they are, in fact, walking backward in terms of what the Constitution is all about and what the whole separation of powers issue is all about. I think there's an awful lot of repair work that's going to have to be done by the next president.
Right. They're literally walking backwards to King George.
Yeah. No, I mean, that literally, their centralization of power in the executive branch without any check It goes against everything that our forefathers intended when they put the Constitution together.
And there's also a tremendous frustration, I feel, on behalf of just being a citizen of this country, that if you do not have any traction in either the House or the Senate or the Supreme Court, for that matter, that that this is going to go unpunished. And you really, there's no part of my brain that can figure out how we reverse this other than hopefully during the midterms change the face of the government.
Well, I've often said that we govern our democracy either through leadership or crisis. And if leadership is there, then hopefully we avoid crisis. Otherwise, we're a country that's largely driven by crises, and I think that's the case today. You know, we've got a huge number of crises that are out there, whether it's energy or health care policy or the budget or issues related to immigration, the war. I mean, all of these are huge crises that are driving policy in this country. And ultimately what happens is that that undermines trust of people in our system of government. So how does it change? It changes if you have leadership. I don't see that happening anytime soon. It changes if you usually have a huge crisis, but 9/11 didn't change things very much. Or it changes because people are so angry they go to the polls and decide, you know, that they're going to throw people out. And I think ultimately that's probably the one area that hopefully our country can be saved by, is the power that rests with the people and the power to vote.
If they don't trick some of those people into voting against their own interests, that's what scares me about this divided country thing, is that I think it served this administration and the Republicans to keep people divided.
Well, I think there are two problems. One, it served them to keep it divided because, you know, to some extent, the thing that really bothers me is that both parties kind of play to this, you know, this kind of party base, and they've developed all of these districts through redistricting that create all of these safe districts, and very frankly, it makes people that much more extreme. They don't care about the center. They don't care about kind of ordinary people. They just care about getting their base out to vote. I had a group of students at our institute this past week. These students, there's no outreach to these students by either party. They don't want students to register and vote because they don't know how these students are going to vote, and that bothers them. Well, you know, that's not what our democracy is all about.
So now let's talk about the Institute a little bit, since we're there now. What is the goal of the Institute, and how does it work, and how do people get involved if they want to?
Well, the purpose of it is to try to inspire young people to get involved in public life. I mean, my immigrant parents told me it was important to give something back to the country. I served 2 years in the Army, and that taught me a lot about giving back to the country. And there was a young president who basically said it was important to give something back to this country. Well, none of those things are impacting that much on young people. We just completed a recent poll. We've done 7 polls over the last 7 years with regards to attitudes of young people with regards to public policy. Always somewhere between 73-75% say they're not interested, they would never choose a career in public life. And that's a concern. You know, the reasons are obvious. They don't think government's relevant. They see a lot of, you know, as I said, this kind of a combative politics that's going on that turns them off. They see the negative ads that go on television. And so as a result, young people are not interested, and yet they think the country's headed in the wrong direction. They're interested in issues, but they're not interested in serving. So the purpose of our institute is to try to see if we can get young people interested. We have an internship program in Washington. We have a leadership program for student body officers. We have a master's program in public policy. I do a lecture series. We have a number of programs, all of which are aimed to see if we can light some candles in these young people so they'll take an interest in public life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm having a hard time lighting candles in older people. What are you kidding? Yeah.
Right.
You would think with the young people that they wouldn't be so jaded. What I find with people in my audience when I perform is that they're just not informed. And, you know, I've talked to people on this show. We had Robert Scheer on the show, and he doesn't blame the people. He's a smart journalist, and he doesn't blame the people because, you know, people have a lot to do. And when the government is putting out what you're talking about, they can't be bothered with it. It's just a shame that people aren't awakened to their civic duty and understand how government serves them.
I think that's a big problem. You know, my sense from because I sat down with these, we had a bunch of student body officers there over the last 10 days, and I basically said, you know, why is it? Why is this the case? And they basically said, you know, look, we don't see Washington as very relevant. They're basically back there fighting each other. They're not dealing with the crises that face this country. You know, and we look at these elections. I mean, we had a horrible election here in this last primary. You know, candidates kicking the hell out of each other. And what happens is 29% of the public turns out to vote, so that less than a third of those qualified to vote have any impact in our system. So the examples are not very good. And the end result is that people in our system, there's a smaller and smaller group of people who are involved in politics, and they tend to be this narrow, extreme wedge on both sides. And we're losing the middle in this country, and that, I think, is dangerous.
Well, do you want to talk a little bit about candidates? Are you willing to get partisan in terms of Democratic hopefuls and what you think about the midterms in a second?
Sure.
All right. Well, let's continue this conversation. We'll take a break. We're talking to Leon Panetta, Bill Clinton's former White House chief of staff, and we'll be back with him in just a second.
Half man, half lethal weapon. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest on the phone is Bill Clinton's former White House Chief of Staff, Leon Panetta of the Panetta Institute. You can link to that at markmaron.com if you want to check that out and see what programs they have available for you or your kids or just to see what's going on with people who are doing the work trying to reinvigorate interest in government. Mr. Panetta, let's talk about the midterm elections, the future the presidential elections, and also what you just said before the break. Is the what is being seen as a schism within the Democratic Party in terms of that people are forgetting about the middle and that there's a fringe element. But I also see a type of moderate Democrat that I don't know if Bill Clinton could be called one, but there's a type of Democrat that is saying that certain more progressive Democrats are fundamentalist progressives and they don't want to get in on board to appeal to more people. How do we solve these issues?
Well, you know, Bill Clinton is a good example of a politician that basically reached out to the whole party. I mean, you know, what he talked about were kind of values that, you know, whether you're liberal, whether you're in the center, whether you're conservative, you know, these were concerns that everybody had. He could speak to that. He had a, you know, he was sympathetic to all views, listened to all people. But when he walked in a room, whether it was a group of businessmen or whether it was a group of activists, he could talk to them. And I think we're lacking that in politics these days. There, you know, people walk in the room and they just want to basically talk to, you know, people who are on one extreme or the other. They don't want to do that that outreach that's so important. I'm just a believer, frankly, that, you know, they all talk about this country being red and blue, but I've been to all those states, you know, whether they're throughout the Midwest, you know, and I have certainly lived in the blue states. But I have to tell you, families that are out there are concerned about the same issues. They're concerned about their ability to educate their kids. They're concerned about the price of housing. They're concerned about their jobs. They're concerned about, you know, kind of basics, and somebody's got to talk to those issues, because that's what counts in this country, is someone that understands the challenges that every working family faces.
But I guess some of the criticism in terms on trying to appeal and being able to talk to both the progressives and the business community is that, you know, certain compromises are made on both sides that work against progressive values and sort of encourage the corporate takeover of the government. Or you know, I mean, there are some negative elements of these North American trade agreements that we're seeing repercussions of that through immigration. I mean, it's very hard to accommodate both sides.
No, but you know what? That's what leadership's all about.
Right.
Leadership is not about taking one direction and walking off a cliff and saying, "Oh well, you know, I couldn't get anything done, so at least I walked off a cliff." Well, thank you very much. That doesn't do very much for me.
Mm-hmm.
I expect people who get elected to, you know, to sit in a room, roll up their sleeves, talk to both sides, and try to find the kind of solutions that produce, you know, the kind of government that will respond to the crises that we're facing. I mean, you know, this is a country right now that is facing, you know, huge gas prices, energy problems. 46 million uninsured in this country. We're facing problems with a budget that is running deeper and deeper into the red. We're facing immigration problems. We're facing problems with global warming and our environment. And people back there are just kind of flapping their lips, but nothing gets done about these crises. So, you know, from my point of view, I want people who get elected to office who are willing to deal with those issues. And, you know, yes, they may have to compromise. Yes, they may have to find consensus. But damn it, find a solution.
Okay, so let's keep that in mind, what you just said, and looking ahead towards the 2008 Democratic candidate for president. Two questions. Is Hillary the one, number one question, and number two question, is Gore going to run?
Well, you know, and the first question, I honestly think that she has to decide whether she wants to run first and foremost. I know there's a lot of people around her who would like her to run.
She's running, isn't she? I thought that was decided.
No, I don't think that's decided. I mean, at least my, from the people I talk to, that isn't a decision that has been made.
Was that person her?
No, okay. No. But you know, I think it's probably. I think it's probably right, knowing her. I think that, deep down she hasn't made that decision yet, and I think that's okay. I mean, I think she's got a ways to go. She has to be comfortable with it. If she decides to go, Bush himself said she'd be a formidable candidate, and I think she will. And she is a bright person. She is able. She's someone, I think that, having been there, understand the challenges that are involved. So... I don't know that we're there yet.
What about Gore?
I don't think Gore's going to do it. I mean, obviously he's getting a lot of attention with his movie and with the issues involved with global warming. But you know, I think deep down, he loves this stuff where he looks deeply into an issue, he reads into it, he really has become an expert on it. I think he feels good about what he's doing now, and he too understands that. Once you say you're running for president, all of that kind of goes away, and you're considered just another ambitious politician. I'm not sure he wants to do that.
What about Bill Clinton? Could he run again? Could we make that happen?
You know, Bill Clinton loved that job. Let me tell you, I've never seen a president or a candidate, for that matter, who wanted the presidency as bad as he did, and it showed. I suspect that at this point in the game, he's now beyond that. He's doing an awful lot of other things, and that's probably what he's going to continue to do.
All right, Leon Panetta, thank you so much for joining us. You're very informative and a good-spirited person. I appreciate it.
Good, Mark. Good to talk to you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, so, that was interesting. Can he run, Jim?
Yes, he can, yeah. If you're separated by one... 4 years, I think.
No kidding.
You can have a third turn, can't you?
Yeah. We'll be back in a second and get into what really happened on 9/11.
He's stalking Michael Jackson's stalker, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Folks, I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I spent a good part of my life completely convinced that there was a cabal of evil, powerful people that were executing a grand plan for world domination. And it had been going on for hundreds of years, and there was the outside chance that they were aliens. As I got older, I realized that there is indeed a cabal of evil people, evil, powerful people, and that their connection to the original designers of the plan is primarily stylistic, and they are not aliens. They are within the government and financial sectors around the world. The question is, did our government, military, and intelligence agencies, along with the titans of the financial sector, plan and execute the 9/11 attacks to consolidate power for the long term? I have always felt that they were complicit in knowing that it would happen and allowing it to happen, but I had a hard time wrapping my brain around them actually carrying it out as a task or a series of tasks. With us today is Dr. David Ray Griffin, a professor emeritus of theology and religion at the Claremont School of Theology here in California. He is the author of several books on 9/11. He wrote The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration 9/11. He wrote the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and the upcoming book, Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action. Dr. Griffin has dedicated his life at this point to sorting details out from what happened on that day and what the government's line is on what happened on that day and the incongruities that lead him to believe that it was indeed executed from the halls of power and industry in this country with the help of other governments and intelligence services around the world. Welcome to the show, Dr. Griffin.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be with you.
Great. Many of our listeners may not be familiar with the investigation going on by yourself and like-minded people. So from the outset here, I want to make sure I am clear on one thing. You believe that the entire 9/11 attack was orchestrated by forces within our own government with the help of some international intelligence agencies.
That's right. I don't know about the international intelligence, but certainly that it was an inside job.
I say national intelligence because there's a lot of references to the Pakistani intelligence sector. I believe that's the ISI, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
We don't know how much these are, false leads, but.
Let's talk about the things we do know about. First off, before we get into that, you're a theology professor. What brought you to this? I know that we all were affected by 9/11, but this is a complete new trajectory for you.
Well, somewhat. I've been interested in political issues for a long time, and during the 90s, I was spending most of my time on a large manuscript on global issues. And then when 9/11 occurred, I originally accepted the standard liberal view that this was blowback for U.S. foreign policy, so I started working more intensely on that issue and had been working on that for about a year and a half, that is a separate book on American foreign policy, when evidence came my way that 9/11 was more than it seemed to be. When I first looked at some evidence, I didn't find it convincing, but a few months later, found some really strong evidence, and pretty quickly saw that it had to be an inside job.
Now, the evidence, I guess, paradigm that exists now, the strongest evidence that 9/11 Truth organizations and yourself sort of base our argument on is that the planes could not have brought down the towers on their own, that the towers fell at such a rate as to imply that they did not fall because of the planes hitting them, and it was physically impossible, that 7 World Trade Center didn't seem to be hit by anything, that just dropped out of nowhere, and that the hole in the Pentagon is questionable in its size, and the trajectory of what the plane would have had to have done in order to facilitate hitting the Pentagon on a side of the building, which you say in your lectures was fairly unoccupied and under construction, would have been quite a feat for even an amazing pilot. These are the principal tenets of the argument, right?
These are, yeah, I would say that the strongest evidence is the evidence from the towers and Building 7. That the evidence from the Pentagon is very strong that the official story can't be true, that is, that it was hit by Flight 77 under the control of an al-Qaeda hijacker. Some very strong evidence also is the failure of the standard procedures to intercept the planes. And then a fourth big one is the behavior of Bush and his Secret Service at the school that morning. So all four of those point in the direction of actual complicity in the attacks, not just foreknowledge.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I have a brain that goes this direction, and I have a hard time thinking that this particular group of politicians, certainly they're capable of evil, and certainly I have always felt that they were complicit in their negligence because there was a presidential daily briefing delivered that said they're going to attack in planes, and that was disregarded. But part of me it seems, even when I look at President Bush's reaction and I listen to your lecture, part of me thinks that is there a chance that some of this stuff on that morning was just incompetence and they did not have their act together as much as you would think they would, and they were not prepared to deal with this type of thing happening all at once? Is there a chance in your mind also that maybe, you know, maybe it was orchestrated by CIA operatives or people underneath the radar of the administration, that even if it was a conspiracy, that the that President Bush might not have known about it?
Yeah, we don't know whether Bush knew in advance, and as you say, his expression in that video that most people have seen in at least in Michael Moore's movie does look like he was genuinely puzzled. So some people within the movement suspect that maybe he was brought in only after the fact. So nothing hinges on the question whether Bush himself knew. Most people think that it would have been Cheney and Rumsfeld who would have been the masterminds of this.
So Cheney and Rumsfeld realized that, you know, they were willing to take a hit of up to 30,000 Americans in order to facilitate
3,000.
No, I know, but I mean, it could have come later in the day. There could have been more people there.
Oh, that's right. The towers could have killed far more people, surely.
Yeah. So this was the Vice President of the United States. Now, look, I believe that these guys are evil bastards. I don't like any of them. But I guess my issue when it comes down to this is that if it is true, if some of the things that you were saying is true, you know, how do we get to the bottom of it, and how do we stop from losing a lot of people, a lot of progressive thinking people who are sensitive, passionate, curious people, of being completely overwhelmed by the possibilities you explain, and losing their minds to this as opposed to being proactive in the political process? Is that a weird question?
Well, I understand the question, but you know, first of all, anything like this, it has to be judged in terms of the evidence and not in terms of our a priori judgments of what people might or might not do. Also, with regard to that a priori judgment, we have to look at the history of our country, of its imperial enterprises, and of its military, and see what the record in the past has been. And here you see that our military and our political economic leaders have been very careless with life. We know now that they fabricated the intelligence to go to war in Iraq. And here we're talking about several thousand Americans killed, probably more than 100,000 Iraqis killed, and how many in Afghanistan. Life is cheap to these people. They don't think in these terms. They think in terms of strategic, geopolitical, and financial benefits. With regard to losing people in the progressive movement, you know, dealing with this rather than politics, we in the movement believe this is the central political issue, because look at how many things the Bush administration has gotten away with, all sorts of which you would have thought would have led to impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, Dr. Griffin, but I also understand that by virtue of some of the historical evidence we have, you know, around, say, the Kennedy assassination, is that that debilitated a lot of sensitive, passionate, progressive thinkers for 40 or 50 years here, and there still isn't a clear resolution. My question is that, you know, if you could find some convincing evidence, or at least convincing evidence in the sense of somebody who's willing to rat this plan out, that I just don't know how it doesn't become a prolonged, unsolvable escapade that diminishes some of our power.
Well, of course, that's another question. Is the issue what's the truth of what happened, or is the question the pragmatic question of should we be looking for the truth, or should we be trying to expose it, even if we're convinced that this is the case?
Oh.
And we in the movement believe both things fit together. That is, that this is the truth. And it's important to expose it, because we believe that the, you know, I've got another book coming out, I'm just proofing today, in fact, called 9/11 and American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. And what we're arguing in this book is that 9/11 has been the main pretext for this new, much more virulent form of American imperialism that we've seen in the since 9/11. And that until 9/11 is exposed, they'll keep playing the terrorism card, to keep jacking up military spending and keep invading other countries and doing just virtually anything they want to do.
Okay. All right, hold that thought. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and finish our conversation. My guest is Dr. David Ray Griffin from 9/11 Truth. He's the author of several books on the topic, and we're going to find out you know, what we can do. And I got a couple of practical questions I want to ask as well. Stay with us.
He was willing to share his cell with Pat Kennedy, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest is Dr. David Ray Griffin, independent speculative investigator, a professor at theology and religion at Claremont School of Theology here in California, author of several books on 9/11. I'll tell you, I'd not dismiss this, but I know I'm vulnerable to getting overly obsessed with what we're talking about. And I watched the your presentation. I watched some stuff last night. And there's certainly 7 World Trade Center dropping out of nowhere is baffling. The other things, I know that you go out of your way to say, look, engineers state the steel core would not melt, a lot of things. But we've had no real event like this take place. Is there a possibility in your mind, being a student of religion, a professor of religion, that with focus and with some sort of evil synchronicity, that these events, that plane could have hit the Pentagon, that those planes were not just a set decoration to a planned implosion of the World Trade Center, and that event could have happened naturally by virtue of them hitting it, and this could have been just an attack? Is there any part of you that believes that there is an outside chance that that is possible?
No.
Okay.
And particularly as you said, Building 7 itself... Because with the Trade Center, you know, people can always say, oh, gee, the planes caused it to do this or that. But with Building 7, you can't do anything about the planes. This would be the first steel frame high-rise building in history, 47 stories high. So in most cities, this would be the tallest building in town. This is a phenomenal event. First such building in history to collapse totally because of fire. And the 9/11 Commission, in its report, which I wrote a book on, will not even mention it. NIST, now, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, is the one that has put out the official report on the towers, but it has withheld its report on the World Trade Center. So after several years, it cannot issue a report giving any sort of plausible explanation as to why Building 7 collapsed, if it was not through the use of explosives.
My initial thought was, that the owner of the building, what's that guy's name?
Silverstein.
That Silverstein had that thing wired, and that either he knew about the other things possibly happening, or that he has always buildings wired in case he has an excuse to just let it rip to pick up the insurance money.
Well, he did not own the towers. He only owned Building 7, so he could not have wired, unilaterally the Twin Towers. But if one wants to know who might have put the explosives in, it's interesting that the 9/11 Commission or nobody else will mention that Bush's brother was a principal, and their cousin, Wirt Walker III,
the security,
was the CEO of the company, Securecom, which was in charge of security for the World Trade Center from 1999 till 2002.
And this is Marvin.
Marvin Bush, yeah.
Right.
And then, more importantly, Wirt Walker was the CEO.
All right. Well, my buddy Jim here is chomping at the bit. Why don't you go ahead, Jim, and ask Dr. Griffin what's on
your
mind.
Well, this would have to be a huge conspiracy, obvious. I mean, how many people do you see to participated in the towers and the Pentagon?
Yeah, and this is the other, there are two major a priori objections. The one is the one that Mark raised, that is, would they really be so evil? The second one is, well, how could they... how could such a big conspiracy be kept secret? Wouldn't somebody talk? Well, in the first place, not very many people have to be in on the inner details. You know, they have a need-to-know basis. Secondly, all the people who were involved would have been complicit, so they're not going to talk for fear of the gas chamber and various other reasons. Thirdly, people want to say, well, no operations, no government operations are ever kept secret. Well, that's just not true. There have been several big operations. The Manhattan Project was kept secret for a long time, and a lot of people knew about that. We engineered a war in Indonesia in 1957 that killed 40,000 people, and still not one American in a million knows about that.
Well, you'd think that just like if there was an engineer, a guy with a tool belt who had to start rigging the World Trade Center with explosives, he might get drunk and say to his wife, baby, I don't think this is legit.
You don't hire people who are like this. These people are professionals. They've
all
been
right.
doing such operations for a long time. They don't hire idiots.
Right. All right. Well, David Ray Griffin, Dr. David Ray Griffin, I could probably talk to you for a longer time, but I can't right now. I appreciate your time. I do have links to your stuff, your website and your books on my site at markmaron.com. Thank you very much for the information.
Thank you, Mark.
You take care.
Bye.
Bye. Okay. All right. We got Morning 40 Federation next.
He's recovering from separation surgery, Mark Maron.
Dude, just explain 7 World Trade Center to me, Jim. Explain it.
Bad building standards.
Okay.
It's New York. Nobody pays attention to building.
Okay, thank God. Rate. Thank God, man. I was drifting. The alien conspirators were coming back, man. I saw Cheney peeling his face back and revealing burning red eyes and a forked tongue, man. I was going there. You hear that rock and roll in the background? That is Morning 40 Federation. Can I call it rock and roll? Does that date me somehow? I like everything these guys come from. Funk, R&B, brass band, rock. They seem to mix it up into just like that nasty sound that definitely conjures the worst and best of the city they come from, which is New Orleans. And I say worst in a good way. The band is Morning 40 Federation. The new album is Ticonderoga. It's also the street my dad lives on. And they're with us here in studio. We got Josh Cohen, who's sax, vocals, songwriter. Ryan Scully. Who's plays guitar and sings. Welcome aboard, fellas.
Hey,
it's great to be here, man.
It's great to have you. You guys are going to be in Los Angeles. Where are the gigs? I got them right here tonight. What is it tonight? Tomorrow night. The Echo in Los Angeles. Is that in Echo Park? It is? Is that what's his name's bar? Greg Dooley's bar? No.
That's a short stop.
You've been hanging out with him?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, he's been on the show. The Sheen Bar in Glendale, that's kind of by me. Maybe I should go, man. I'm going to come.
We'll get you on the list.
You guys got a lot of energy. You know, like it's like that sound where I can't remember who it reminds me of, but you're definitely putting it all out there. Does it feel that?
You should see the shows.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Who are some of your heroes, man?
I got to say, Jello Biafra is one of my heroes. He just came to our show in San Francisco. Just the veracity and audacity
and his ability not to stop talking is pretty impressive. I had him on the show last week. and then it's like I kept going, Jello, Jello, Jello. Jello, I want to be part of this conversation, dude. but certainly that sound, the Dead Kennedys were great.
Well, I think so, and they really, had a lot of energy and exuberance in their performances.
Chili Peppers? Early Chili Peppers?
I can't stand
the
new
stuff.
Record. It's
early
just,
stuff.
You know, they found their little sound, and now they're...
The old guys.
They're just copying themselves, man. It's just disappointing to
the
me.
The new guys taking down the old guys. Kill your heroes, man. So you guys live in New Orleans? All you come from New Orleans?
No. We're all transplants except our drummer, who's a Cajun from Eunice, Louisiana. I'm from Kansas City. Well, rural Missouri, actually.
Rural Missouri. Good for you for getting out.
Yeah, no.
I lived in 3 different murder capitals in
Maryland. Yeah, where'd you live?
D.C., I grew up when it was murder capital, back when Mary and Barry got busted for crack cocaine with prostitutes.
The party days.
Yeah, and then he got reelected, which blew my mind.
Yeah.
Then I lived in Oakland when it was murder capital. Then I moved to New Orleans when it was murder capital.
When were you up in Oakland? Were you in a band up there?
In the 80s. No, that was before I got into music. I didn't get into music till I moved to New Orleans and started drinking heavily.
Now, let's talk about that drinking problem that you guys have and you seem to have committed to.
Problem? Problem?
No, no, it's not a problem yet. You keep at it, buddy.
It's a problem right now.
See that?
I'm hurting.
It's a problem when it's morning and you don't have a drink in your hand.
There you go. What is Morning 40 Federation? What does that mean? Where does that come from?
Well, there was a guy at a corner store a long time ago. My friend Dick Huckel and I were walking across the street, and the guy said, "Look, I need 67 cents, man." He had some change in his hand, but he needed 67 cents. We were trying to speculate. Now, it's a very particular number of change that he needs. What he obviously needs something. He's got something in mind.
Yeah.
It happened to be a corner store where they had big, huge tub full of 40 ounces in ice.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's how they roll in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And we speculated, well, this guy must need his morning 40.
Yeah.
So we said, well, what if we started a little foundation where the Morning 40 Foundation, it'd be like a Salvation Army kind of bucket.
Yeah.
But instead of collecting change, we give out change until noon to the people who are desperately in need of a malt liquor.
Yeah.
Then we decided, well, one step further, what if it was Morning 40 Federation and it was a government-sponsored agency that forced people to drink malt liquor in the morning to keep them complacent and apathetic, so the government could do just about anything they wanted and not get any citizens to raise a stink about it. Well, it turns out, I guess, they didn't need the malt liquor, did they?
No, they went ahead and did it anyways. They're well on their way to pulling that off. Well, that's pretty funny. So how many of you guys were down there during Katrina? All of you?
Just me. Just me. Everybody else left.
And were you staying at a place that could you live?
No, I was in Mid City. My house is in the Ninth Ward, but in the Upper Ninth Ward. The Ninth Ward is divided by a canal.
Yeah.
And the Upper Ninth Ward did not get flooded.
Right.
But it got damaged. But my bright idea was, I'll stay in Mid City at my buddy's 2-story house. You know, it's a big house. I was like, this is tough house, you know.
I wasn't
worried about flooding. I was worried about wind more, you know.
Yeah.
And which was totally ignorant.
Do you own the house or you just staying
I
there?
I own it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I stayed there. I was there for about 3 days. Helicopters came and took my friends and we helped. Since we had a 2-story house, we had we were helping out a bunch of families that were there that were in single-story houses, mm-hmm. and there was like 2 feet of water in all the single-story house, about 6 feet in the streets. And this helicopter came, and it just stopped, you know, at this time there's helicopters everywhere.
Yeah.
And it stopped over his house, and the guy drops down on the house next door, the roof next door, and turns out my buddy's cousin was flying the helicopter.
Yeah.
So that's why we got special treatment, you know, like his parents, you know, grandparents are like, go get him. You know, get Pete now, you know. And he did. But then Pete said, we're not going until everybody, all these families, you know, there's like 12 people, so they can only take two at a time. And my wife and I, it was our turn to go, and the guy drops down and he says, Pete Becknell, you're going now. We're almost out of gas. And so they basically, you know, like, he's like, you're going now, you know, gun, because you're the reason we came here.
Right.
And so my wife and I were left there. They didn't come back for us.
I hope you're not talking to Pete anymore.
He was very disturbed by it. He was crying and stuff, you know. Like,
he was sad.
My buddy's coming.
Because
he didn't know what happened, you know. And I ended up swimming from Mid-City about 3 miles, you know. I had to swim through some spots.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to get back to my house because I suspected that it was dry.
Yeah.
And so I went through the water with my bike. There was one other guy left at the house, so I left my wife there.
Yeah.
And then I took this girl's bike. They had these really nice mountain bikes and stuff. And I was like, no, I'm taking the girl's bike because I didn't want to get jacked. You
right,
know?
Right.
Because there was all these reports, everybody out there with guns, all this. So
now they would just say, look at the wuss on the girl's bike.
Yeah.
As opposed to, let's take that guy out.
Exactly.
So where's the, did now, I guess the real question is, because I believe I can hear New Orleans in the music.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if that's by virtue of a Cajun drummer or what's influenced you down there, but I was amazed because I was just there recently. I know a comic down there had me out. I performed down there at a benefit. Wild Bill
Dykes?
Yeah, Wild Bill Dykes had me down there. Nice guy. You probably drank with him, right?
I haven't actually met him, but I've heard good things about his show down there, his shows.
Yeah.
Did you want at Jack's? Is that where you
performed? We did. Yeah.
Yeah, we play there all the time.
That's a good, that would seem like it's a rock club. It actually is a rock club. But, we went out just one night, and I was incredibly inspired by the perseverance of people who were still there, even though they're shell-shocked, and you don't know how or when the rest of the city's going back. I had no idea how bad it really is there and how much of the city is abandoned. But just going down that one street where all those clubs are, and hearing, I was able to hear, some sort of, some cats doing almost Dixieland jazz. Young cats. Do you know these guys? They got, a
clarinet. Jazz Vipers, maybe?
No, they had the something-something club.
Hot Club of New Orleans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those guys are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing classic, almost Dixieland jazz stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then you just go down the street, then you hear rock, and then you hear some blues, and you hear that old guy who plays guitar and you can't understand him that well.
Yeah.
And who sits in that bar that seats three people. What's that guy's name? Do you know that guy? He's a white dude, plays blues, just him and a guitar, and he looks pretty beat up.
Coco Robichaud.
Yeah, Coco Robichaud. I went in. Everyone's telling me go see Coco, and I go into this room. There's four people there. I'm like, wow, there's some following this guy has.
That's
you know that guy.
That's what happens when you play too often in New Orleans. People figure they'll see.
Ben, sounds like you've seen everything down there, man. That's our stomping grounds. All that stuff you're talking about.
Well, it's like one night, and I really got that amazing feeling. You watch Ken Burns' documentary about jazz and everything. Is that you really see that so much of American musical history is right there. It all converges on that place, and some of that stuff's coming out of this thing that you guys made.
Yeah, it's a big influence. Yeah.
It's like steeping in the tea of New Orleans culture. I mean, through osmosis, we couldn't possibly avoid being influenced by all that.
Yeah.
You know, there's just
But there are
some
bands, some rock bands that it doesn't seem like they are.
No.
Like there's some bands that in New Orleans that you could see in Detroit.
Anywhere.
But that's not what we are.
Sure. Yeah,
I saw a cover band thing going on in one of the clubs. I was disappointed. Because in New Orleans, you have high expectations. And I'm like, this is going to be great. And they're like, those guys are cool. Those guys are playing a Van Halen song.
And not very well.
Exactly. Yeah, they got the long hair going. I'm like, what happened there? And, of course, that's a place where people are crowded.
Oh, yeah.
Saw hip-hop on the same street. What were you thinking, Josh? You got something on your mind?
Well, you know, I'm just thinking, first of all, as far as us sounding like a New Orleans band, I mean, part of that is just due to the osmosis factor.
Sure.
It's not very conscious, I don't think. And, you know, we get drunk. And we write some good songs. We write a lot of bad songs that don't stand the test of time, and we never bother to try to record them or get in the practice space with them. But sometimes, you know, a lot of it had to do with going out to the bar, getting
hammered,
and then going home and leaving the song idea on your answering machine before you forgot it.
All right, dude, this is me.
Yeah.
I'm calling myself because then I'm bad at ba-ba. All right, man, I'll check you later. Like that?
Basically, yeah.
Kind of like that. Hey, you're good at that, man.
Thanks, man.
You can start a band, too.
I'm a comic. You don't know how many cryptic notes I have of myself where I'm like, when I used to get high and I used to write things down.
Yeah, you used to, right?
I did. It's been a long time. You'll get old, dude. All right. If you're lucky. If not, then maybe you'll become mythic. But look. Yeah, it's quite a gamble. But anyway, so I'd get high and I'd be like sitting there in the bar and I'd just write something like, beans and rockets. And then like put it in my pocket. You know, like the next day I'd be like, the hell was that? That was probably genius because that's a stretch there, you know. Anyways.
Yeah, it's true. The drunk factor definitely can disguise bad ideas and make them look good to your own drunken
It's sometimes just the note itself, if you just look at what you wrote down, is worth keeping for it just because it
I got a whole desk drawer full of
those. Oh, good. Keep those.
I remember your beans and rockets bit. That was great.
Thanks a lot, man.
What happened to that bit?
I can't remember it, man.
Well, too bad. bad.
So this cover here, this was a now someone explained this once to me. This is kind of a little bit morbid, but funny, right? The refrigerators I heard were all over the place, but this X usually represented there was a number of dead people in the house or no? How'd that
work? Bottom portion where you see the zero. That's the number of people found dead in the house now.
I'm glad you left that zero.
We did.
Because that would have been really kind of morbid.
We don't want to creep anybody
out. If the cover was Morning 40. Oh, there you go. MF 40. I get it.
Yeah. Took a while.
I'm an idiot.
It's all those drugs you used to do.
It's very specific to New Orleans. Because we had that guy Chris Rose on. You know Chris Rose?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's great.
Yeah, he was. I met him when I was in New Orleans, and we had him on the show to read a little bit of his stuff. And I talked to a New York Times writer. I try to keep up with New Orleans because I think it's important that people continue to remember that things are not okay there. But they're going to get back as long as people know that they still need help down there. But you guys are rocking, if I can say that. Tomorrow night, the Echo at Los Angeles. Echo, that's in, we're at Echo Park, right? We covered that. I'm not stupid.
On Sunset, I think.
Yeah, okay. And then on tomorrow's Tuesday. Wednesday night, you're going to be at the Scene Bar in Glendale, which is probably closer to me. Maybe I'll try to go to that. Thank you very much. I don't want to screw up your names. Josh and... What's your first name again?
Ryan.
Brian Scully. Ryan Scully.
Ryan
Josh
Scully.
Cohen. Saxophone, guitar, both write songs and sing. Morning 40 Federation is the name of the album. You can get it at markmaron.com. You can
actually, Ty Conderoga is the name of the album. Morning 40 Federation is the name of the band.
Dude, I'm so high.
I know, man. I shouldn't have given you that laudanum before the
Where'd you get laudanum?
In the Bay Area.
Oh, we drank it all last night.
Civil War soldier gave
it to me. www.morning40.com will take you to their MySpace page. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Take care. We'll be back with closing statements.
F***ed up with my calories.
And now, floodwaters are creeping into his pants. Mark Maron.
Seven World Trade just drops. It just sinks into the ground, bro.
Building codes. Rotten building codes, just like the Twin Towers.
Don't you understand, man? They had like 50, like, ordained in the arts of darkness engineers who went into the World Trade Center, Seven World Trade and the towers, and rigged them up with explosives. So they fold in. That's the other thing I don't understand is they keep saying that they've fallen on themselves. The World Trade Center did not fall in on themselves. They flayed open.
Michael Jackson's nose is about to collapse. What government's involved in that?
Yes, I think the Pakistani intelligence agency is involved in that because he's in Dubai, isn't he? Huh?
Coincidence?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
How many people are in that nose? That's what I'm asking.
Thousands.
Thousands of
young boys.
I'm not going to trivialize this guy's efforts because I don't want to piss those people off because then all of a sudden you're part of it.
Claremont Men's College.
Yeah. But then you become part of the conspiracy. It's like you become added on to it. Mark Maron discredited Dr. Griffin on June 19th, 2006. That was also the day, if you'll notice, that Kim Jong-il threatened to launch a nuclear device into the air. And also the same day that that the newly elected leader of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Bishop Catherine Jeffords Schori, said that gays were okay. Now, I'm not saying Maron had anything to do with these other events, but clearly his discrediting of Griffin...
But what else could explain his career?
Exactly. Maron got what he deserves. He should call Alex Jones' show and find out the truth.
You think anybody could last in a career that long with that material? No. The government had to help him out.
Exactly, man. Hey, I read Nostradamus. I'm not in it. That's the only reason I read it. Maybe there's an outside chance that I'm involved somehow, and I should probably know what part I play.
You read Nostradamus? That thing is impossible to read. You have to figure out what the hell it means.
I didn't read it. I did a search on Nostradamus. I didn't do anything. I just made it. You know what I mean?
I understand.
Talking out my arse. It is nice, though, that this church bishop, this new Episcopal... She's a chick, and she says that homosexuals are it's not a sin. They're God's gifts that just like to do the thing the other way. Here we go. According to a new book, maybe we should introduce it. Oh, this is Short Order News for Monday. Yeah. Here it comes. According to a new book, Al-Qaeda came within 45 days of carrying out a lethal gas attack in New York City's subway system in 2003. The attack was called off by Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri during a brief period when he reportedly tried to give up smoking, fried food, and killing people on the subway. Al-Qaeda had planned to place poison gas devices in subway cars, but the plot was foiled when the terrorists were supposed to plant the devices. They were supposed to plant it, and they decided it would be quicker to take a cab. Because it's got
a lot of traffic in that town.
Former Enron Corporation president Jeffrey Skilling says he contemplated suicide after his company crumbled and authorities began to ratchet up legal pressure on him. Skilling changed his mind when it dawned on him that if he could lie to his own employees, he could certainly lie to himself. Skilling prepared for his trial by hiking 30 miles a day in Utah, in the Utah wilderness, and eating worms, which led to reports that he had resorted to cannibalism. Norway has started construction on a doomsday vault to serve as a Noah's Ark for seeds in case of global catastrophe. According to Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg, quote, agreements were made with nations around the globe to protect hundreds of fruits, vegetables, trees, and the kindest bud you'll ever see this side of Maui, bro. Woohoo! End quote. Up until now, the world's biggest repository for seed has been Paris Hilton. Pow! Bang zoom! Look out! That one snuck up on you. There's a pants full. Hey, that's it. It's the Mark Maron Show. Tomorrow we've got the Margaret Cho, Jim, on the phone probably. Steve Hofstetter's coming down. Maxine Waters, Congresswoman. Paul Waldman with his book about being a patriot. Good night, sheeple. For Media Matters.